From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. In a moment, the God problem with Howard Bloom. Get ready for some fireworks. And later tonight, the father of modern-day ufology, Stanton Friedman, his disclosure right around the corner. Here's what's happening. Hurricane Isaac spun into southern Louisiana coast late on Tuesday, sending floodwaters surging and unleashing fierce winds as residents hunkered down behind boarded-up windows, some leaving. New Orleans waited out another storm on the eve of Hurricane Katrina's seventh anniversary, hoping the city's strengthened levees will hold. Isaac is a massive storm spanning nearly 200 miles from its center. It made landfall near the mouth of the Mississippi, but it was zeroing in on New Orleans, about 90 miles to the northwest, turning streets famous for all-hour celebrations into ghost boulevards. Now, while many residents stayed put, evacuations were ordered in low-lying areas of Louisiana and Mississippi. Officials ordered the closure of the state's 12 shorefront casinos as well. More than 100,000 homes and businesses without power as I speak. And oil prices rising as Hurricane Isaac approached the U.S. Gulf Coast, forcing companies in the region to close down oil production platforms and refineries. More than 90% of U.S. Gulf of Mexico oil production shut down on Tuesday. That's almost a million barrels per day of Gulf Coast refinery capacity. Captain Kelly Sweeney, who went through that entire BP oil disaster with us, he's on the line with us now. Kelly, this hurricane, I don't think will be as bad as Katrina, but it's going to disrupt the flow of oil, isn't it?
It certainly will, George. And ahoy to you. It's great being back with you and all the Coast listeners. And you're absolutely right. The ships cannot get to the refineries to unload their oil. So it's definitely, in my opinion, going to affect the price of gas and the flow of petroleum products coming out of the Gulf.
Are these short-term, Kelly? I mean, once the hurricane hits inland, you know, and the Gulf stays relatively quiet, can those ships get back in?
Well, the safest place in general for ships, Georgia, in a hurricane is offshore, because you can at least maneuver around as best as possible. If you're in port tied up, you're just going to get slammed, and it's far worse. So, yes, it'll disrupt traffic for a while. What my concern is right now is that there are 23 deepwater drilling ships, similar to the Deepwater Horizon that caused the BP oil spill, that are working in the Gulf. Now, these ships take like 3 days to pull up all their equipment and get out of the way, so they're just going to have to ride out the hurricane. And they're not tethered, you know, they're tethered to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico by a drill pipe that could be 1 or 2 miles long. They're not anchored out there and secure. So if they lose power or they're not able to hold position on there where they're drilling, you could have a disaster, no doubt.
Okay, I have a feeling, Kelly, we're going to be talking to you more this week. Now, listen to this story out of Yosemite National Park, which is a favorite among families looking to just go rustic in one of the nation's most majestic settings. It has now become a scene of public health scares, a crisis. Two visitors there have died from a rodent-borne disease following overnight stays. Now, park officials have sent visitors, 1,700 visitors, letters or emails telling them that they possibly might have been exposed to this disease. These people have contracted a pulmonary syndrome after spending time in one of the 91 signature tent cabins at Curry Village around the same time in June. The illness is spread by contact with rodent feces, saliva, or by inhaling exposed airborne particles. Two have died already. Health officials in the U.S. and Canada, they're investigating a possible outbreak of salmonella poisoning from mangoes imported from Mexico that may have sickened more than 100 people. At least 73 people in California have been infected with a strain of salmonella linked to the mangoes. A man wandering around a Del Mar, Maryland poultry farm in a drunken stupor turned off the power to 3 chicken houses, causing the deaths of nearly 70,000 chickens. Confidence among U.S. consumers falling in August, by the most in 10 months as households grew more pessimistic about their employment prospects and the economic outlook. Let's turn to Mish Shedlock, registered investment advisor here. Mish, why the confidence drop? What's going on?
Oh, my gosh. Look at the regional surveys from the Fed. The Philadelphia Fed, the New York Fed, the Richmond Fed, the Chicago Fed, all are reporting contraction. The Texas Fed is reporting just above contraction. So we're seeing this sentiment match what you and I talked about, which is a plunge in new orders. New orders aren't coming in. Manufacturers aren't expanding production. They're not hiring. Businesses aren't hiring. Consumers are pulling in the shell. What do you expect?
Not good for the fourth quarter.
It is not good for the fourth quarter. George, I mean, we talked about this. I really believe we're back in recession. If this isn't recession, what is it? Now, we can say it's statistically a non-recession because the government's spending all of this money and keeping GDP positive. But that's really what we're talking about here. But recessions actually begin typically with GDP not in contraction. Even if you look back to 2007, the NBER, that's the official arbiter, the official designator of recessions, said the recession started in November or December of 2007. The economy actually didn't start contracting until March. So these are the conditions that I'm talking about. This is what we're discussing here on the show, telling people, well, you know, technically maybe we're not in recession yet. George, I think they're going to backdate it to now.
Okay, Mish, we'll be in touch. Don't, by the way, Mish's blog and his website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, the God problem. Howard Bloom joins us. I call him the human computer. You'll find out why in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. A couple hours here with the human computer, Howard Bloom, whose latest work is ready to hit the stands, the God problem. Howard, this is going to be tough tonight. You know that. How are you?
Well, yes, you've been looking forward to this for years, George. I'm finally getting in on the God frequency.
You are.
Yeah, I'm doing very well, and the God problem is, strangely enough, not what you would expect. You know, there is now an atheist top 10, top 100 on Amazon.com, and there are four authors who've been dominating it for the last 14 days. One of them is Richard Dawkins, who has declared himself, in essence, the new pope of a form of militant atheism that is totally intolerant, says religion has to be wiped off the face of the earth and is responsible for every scourge of mankind. Another author is Christopher Hitchens, who a brilliant man who unfortunately died 5 or 6 months ago. But Christopher Hitchens also takes that intolerant tack. And then there's myself and Dinesh D'Souza. And my book was up there in the top 10, duking it out at number 3 for 5 days in a row, despite the fact that it hadn't been published yet. But it's not an atheist book.
No, it's not. The problem is people think that people think you're an atheist.
I am an atheist. I've been an atheist ever since you've known me. I've been an atheist since I was 12 years old. But the fact is that my view of things is heavily influenced by science. Science depends on toleration. Science depends on recognizing that every idea is a hypothesis waiting to be proven, and every hypothesis is something waiting to be overturned by new people, a new generation, or new ideas. That calls for tolerance, pluralism, and freedom of speech. If there are many people that I know, many of my friends believe in God, that's their personal belief system. I have no right to attack that. Because I'm an atheist, that's my personal belief system. I could put out 12 volumes of what sounds like logic and reason, but the logic and reason is never going to prove that there is a God or is not a God. It's a matter of personal faith.
Well, Howard, you know, you and I have talked about this over the years, and you're right. We've been leading up to this work, the God problem. So we could sit down face to face and really talk about this and the belief system as well. You know, I remember a long time ago, I asked you, you know, just walk around, look at the planets, look at the stars, how'd this all happen? And for one moment, one split shining moment, I thought maybe you might change and become a believer.
Well, in a sense, George, that question that you were asking me is the very question at the heart of the God problem. This is a book about cosmic creativity. It's an advantage to be an atheist when you're looking at cosmic creativity, because you have to answer certain basic questions. If there was no God saying, let there be light, Why is there so much light? Where did it come from? What is it all about? If there is no God parting the heavens from the seas, then how in the world did we get heavens and seas? This is a cosmos of what I call in the book shape shock and the supersized surprise, and we'll hit that, I would suspect, in a minute. But the fact is, if there is no God, how did we get quarks? How did we get atoms? How did we get stars? How did we get galaxies? How did we get dreams? How did we get fantasies? How did we get stock markets? How did we get trees? That's something that we in science have to account for. Now, that the accounts that we come up with when we probe this, it is a big mystery. It's a giant question. And when we probe this giant question, that probe is going to be equally valid for those who believe in a God and those who don't. Because when you go back through history, you discover something very strange. The three guys who kicked off modern science were all believers, they were all creationists, and they all believed in intelligent design. And those three guys are Kepler, Galileo, and Newton. Every single one of them believed in the account in the Bible. Now, Galileo said, and he said this in a letter trying to save himself from being burned at the stake, he said, look, God has expressed himself in two different ways. He's expressed himself through the scriptures, but God is trying to reach the masses through the scriptures. So he had to write the scriptures as propaganda. He had to fudge things a little bit. So if you really want to know God's intentions, if you really want to know how God works, if you really want to know what God intends for us, study nature, because nature never breaks God's laws. So what I'm doing with the God problem is looking into, if you're a believer, I'm looking into the language of God. I'm looking into how God does his, her, whatever work. And that's the way it was regarded even by Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein felt that in all of his probing for the underlying geometry of the universe, the underlying mathematical patterns of the universe, he was probing for something much deeper than we normally think. He was probing for the language of God at work.
Howard, even Stephen Hawking, physicist, along with our friend Leonard Mlodinow, I mean, they have questioned the possibility of, is there a God in the universe as well? In your work, tell me how you systematically came up with some of your thoughts and conclusions on the God problem.
Well, I start with something. I mean, look, this is a universe that our normal systems of logic really do not cope with. The book starts with five heresies, and the first heresy is that A does not equal A. A does not equal A. That's very strange. Second heresy is that 1 plus 1 does not equal 2. The third heresy is that the second law of thermodynamics, which is practically wholly in science, is wholly wrong. That the second law of thermodynamics says that all things tend toward disorder. All things fall apart. All things tend toward entropy. Sorry, dead wrong. Doesn't apply to this cosmos at all. Heresy number four is that randomness is not as random as we think. And heresy number five is that information theory, the hot new theory of the latest of the last 30 years, is not really about information. And in fact, it misses the point. Well, a major, major problem, you hit a major problem when you look at 1 plus 1 equals 2. Once upon a time in England in 1835, there were these two guys, John Stuart Mill and his friend George Henry Luce. And John Stuart Mill was a person who would later be named the most important philosopher of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And they were looking at something very new called chemistry. And they noticed that in chemistry, chemists had managed to distill two very strange gases. One was called oxygen. In fact, it had just been called oxygen 20 years earlier. One had been called oxygen. The other one had been called hydrogen. Now look, if 1 plus 1 equals 2, and you take one bell jar full of a gas, and you add it to another bell jar full of another gas, what do you get? Two bell jars full of gas. twice as much gas. And there's no way that those two gases should change. But if you put hydrogen and oxygen together into a bell jar, okay, you still got a gas. Now the trick came. If you put in a match, what are you adding? Heat. So what should you get? Hot gas, right?
Right.
That's not what happened. You put in a match, whammo, you get an explosion. An explosion coming from two gases? How in the world did that happen? But you got something even more. You got this weird substance. Now, the difference between matter and gas is that you can put your finger through a gas, you can see through a gas, you can't put your finger through matter. You can touch it, it's very solid. Well, this is a weird material that came out of this explosion of two gases. You could feel it with your fingertip, but your finger would go right through it, as if it were a gas. If you spilled it on your pants, it would soak in. In fact, it could make very embarrassing stains. And if it fell on the floor, it would soak into the floorboards. It was liquid water.
Two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen.
You got it. Now, we take that for granted, George, But fortunately, George Henry Lewes and John Stuart Mill did not take that for granted. And they said, look, the logic it says that 1 plus 1 equals 2. In our time, we put that slightly differently. We say garbage in, garbage out. Put in a gas, you get out a gas. How in the world did we get this explosion? How in the world did we get this liquid?
And who conceived of it?
What's that?
And who conceived of it?
Yes. Or how did it get conceived? Or how did it conceive itself? Or however you want to put the question, it is a big mystery. And this was a mystery 177 years ago, and these two guys were discussing it over dinner at John Chapman's house at 142 Strand, John Chapman, the publisher. And it's a mystery today because we haven't adequately tackled it. We're sticking with forms of arithmetic and forms of logic that don't really fit the real world. 1 plus 1 does not equal 2 when you're adding these two gases. Under many other circumstances, 1 plus 1 does not equal 2. Sure, 1 apple plus 1 apple in a bag equals 2 apples, but drop those 2 apples into the ground and you get apple trees. What? That defies arithmetic totally. Well, you could say, but you're being crazy here. Arithmetic's not meant to apply to that. If it's not meant to apply to that, in what way does arithmetic and modern math deal with the cosmos? It cannot deal with this thing that George Henry Lewes called emergence.
But Howard, when you, well, it sounds like in the God problem, you might be tipping to the possibility that there's much more here than meets the eye.
There's much more than meets the eye. In fact, I just did a talk last week in an Enlightenment lecture called The Material Power of Immaterial Things, and it's all derived from the God problem. And you could say, the material power of immaterial things, what, have you become a spiritualist or something? Do you believe in ghosts? And no, I don't believe in ghosts at all. You know me, I'm a dead, hard, cold, stiff scientist.
Yes, sure.
And when I talk about the material power of immaterial things, the best way to illustrate it is to use one of the favorite phenomena of science.
2 weeks with me, Howard, you'd be astral projecting. You'd be remote viewing.
Well, you know we share out-of-body experiences and a few things like that.
There's just so much. Well, your work is going to make a lot of people wake up because, you know, it hits that problem where the minute, even the title, The God Problem, oh my gosh, how many people will just read that title and go, what's he saying? There is no God?
Well, what I'm saying is that there is a creative force in the universe that is very, very strange. It's not something weird and spooky. It's something that we as scientists, who have an obligation to understand absolutely everything, we as scientists have to come to understand it. And the God problem is an attempt to understand it. And in order to understand it, it takes off the shackles of our existing forms of logic and reason, and it suggests ways to reforms of reason and logic beyond our current forms.
Is it safe to assume that we do not understand it right now?
Right now, we do not understand it. And I would give you the example of the wave because that really demonstrates the material power of immaterial things. But we're getting close to the hour. So
you've got a couple minutes. We've got some minutes.
Okay, well, let me tell you. Imagine that you've just had a lovely romantic weekend in London with your wife, and you're coming back across the Atlantic on your way to New York City.
Okay.
Below you is the Atlantic Ocean. Well, you can look out the window and see waves. And you can see a wave going as far north as your eye can possibly go. What's more, you can watch it for 15 to 20 seconds, and it retains an identity. And you know darned well that if you were able to follow that wave in a nice lazy blimp, you could follow it 1,000 miles all the way to the coast of Maine. And you also know that if you were a surfer, you could take your surfboard out and ride the thing as it came into the coast. But in reality, a wave doesn't, in a very strange way, a wave does not exist. Well, of course a wave exists. I mean, tell the people, the 230,000 people that were killed in Indonesia in 2004 by a tidal wave, that a wave does not exist. If they were still alive, they'd know better, and certainly their relatives know better. Tell the 19,000 people who died in Fukushima last year that a wave does not exist. So what the heck is this Howard Bloom character doing saying that a wave does not exist? Well, here's how it works. A wave is a nothing.
What do you mean it's
a nothing? It means a no thing. And that means that let's change your perspective. You are now a molecule of water in the middle of the Atlantic. Well, do you visit the coast of Maine 1,000 miles away? Never. You just stay in place and you bob up and down. And when you bob up, you're part of the crest of a wave. When you go down, you're a part of the trough of a wave. But when you go back up again, guess what? You're not a part of the same wave anymore. You're a part of the crest of yet another wave. And then when you bob down, you're part of the trough of another wave. In other words, the wave, and the wave is constantly moving on.
All right, we're going to bob right out of here for a moment, Howard, but we'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. And you're listening to Coast AM. Howard Bloom, our guest for a couple hours, The God Problem. Okay, Howard, where are we going here with this bobbing molecule of water?
Okay, let's remember, we're after the mystery of how immaterial things have a material power. So let's imagine that you're a wave and I'm an atom or a molecule of water. I'm simply bobbing up and down and staying in place. You will come, use me, you will kidnap, seduce, and recruit me in order to get a peak and then in order to get a trough, and you will move on. You'll move on to a bunch of my neighbors and another bunch of neighbors beyond them, and you will be no thing. You'll be a different collection of things, literally every second. And yet you will retain a shape, and yet you will retain an identity that stretches all the way to the north as far as we can see, all the way to the south as far as we can see, and will travel 1,000 miles. How does an immaterial form, an immaterial pattern, an immaterial shape manage to maintain itself despite the fact that it is changing its constituents every second? Now, in a sense, you are a wave and have some idea of this, and I am a wave. I have some idea of this. Why? Because every minute you are swapping out, changing 3 billion blood cells. Every minute you are losing and changing, rearranging a total of over 1 billion synapses in your brain. The same thing is happening with the cells of your skin and the cells of your gut. From one year to another, you are an entirely different patch of material substance. One day you eat a lasagna, the next day you eat a steak, the next day you eat a salad, and yet you do not become a pasta, and you do not become a cow, and you do not become a lettuce. Instead, the lettuce, the lasagna, and the cow become you. You maintain an identity despite the fact that you're a flow, just like that water is a flow. How in the world do you do it? How does a photon, you know, a particle of light, which can be traveling at 760,000 bleeps per second, in other words, little wheels up and down, how does it keep that wiggling up and down going? Why does the wiggling up and down stay within certain narrow boundaries? Why is it describable by something else that's immaterial, a mapper of immaterial patterns? Mathematics, because math is nothing.
Yeah, but there's got to be some design behind this, Howard, that keeps it all together.
Well, here's the trick. I mean, I'm looking for, okay, I give you this the story of the 165 words on a piece of paper. And I give you the example of how you could pull the elaborate form of addition, multiplication, and subtraction from that 165 words. Now, the big mystery is how do these things manage to exist implicit in something? They don't take a god to pull them out, but they do take something to, in a sense, put them in, even if there is nobody to put them in. Now, the trick with imagining a designer to design all of this is that we imagine this in human terms. And humans are very, very visually oriented animals. An awful lot, most of the other animals on the planet feel their way around the world they live in by smell. They feel the way their way around the world by chemical cues. We don't. We manage to interpret light, mm-hmm. and we interpret light in pictures. And in our minds, we interpret light as even more big pictures. So we have between 30 and 40 vision centers in our brain. And for us, designing something means imagining it. I mean, look at the word image right in the middle of the word imagining. To envision it, to come up with a picture of it in our heads, and then we figure out how to make that picture into a reality. Well, imagining that a god must have the process of imagining that comes from 30 to 40 vision centers in the brain and must work by first coming up with a vision of things and then somehow turning the vision into a reality is sort of throwing the problem backwards, because that's a very complex god. And if it takes a very complex god to make a universe, then it takes an even more complex god to make the very complex god and an even more complex god to make him. Now, I'm not trying to convert you to atheism.
That's never going to happen, Howard. You know
that. No, it isn't going to happen, and I'll never be converted from what I believe in. Because the fact is that our belief systems are very peculiar, and they are not based on logic, much as we like to argue after the fact that they are based on
logic. Well, let me ask you two quick things, and tell me your answer to this.
Okay.
Number one, we all need to live on water, right? You brought up water, so let me talk about that for a second.
Right.
We all need to live on water. We got to drink it. It's got to stay in our system. Grass needs it. Trees needs it. Plants need it. They all need it. Without it, everything dies. You agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
What kind of a planet would have the kind of intelligence to allow it to rain most of the time, non-drought times, on objects and creatures that need it? It's like it knows it has to be done. If it never,
you know what us evolutionary thinkers would say. We would say that life has to evolve given the means at its disposal, given the resources at its disposal. And we happen to live on one of the very few planets in the universe with liquid water. Remember, water is only liquid between at freezing point it freezes, and at boiling point it boils away and becomes a gas. And the range in between those two is very narrow when you think of the tremendous temperature ranges between planets. So we happen to be one of the lucky few to live on a planet where there's water. Well, we have adapted to that environment of water. Water has become crucial to us. We took birth in the seas. Now, some of us took birth in the seas as bacteria at a temperature of 220 degrees centigrade and lived on sulfur, and some of us lived on carbon dioxide and were in a more temperate, what we'd consider a temperate range. If there were life elsewhere, it wouldn't necessarily have to be dependent on water. It would have to be dependent on whatever resources it has.
Well, but we do. My point is the planet is aware that we need it and brings it to us.
You know, Lynn Margulis and James Lovelock came up with their Gaia hypothesis.
Right.
And they showed that the planet is like a giant living organism.
It's alive.
So Lynn shied away from using that metaphor. But in the sense that everything collaborates with everything else in order to keep things just right. And the two of them showed how the biosystem, the system of bacteria, plants, and animals work together to maintain the kind of atmosphere that they need and the kind of temperature range that they need, and even to have some minor degree of control over the weather. Now, they did this with computer simulations that demonstrated it brilliantly. And it wasn't a spooky sci-fi sort of thing, because Lynn Margulis, who unfortunately died 4 months ago, but she was a National Medal of Science winner, and her partner James Lovelock, in coming up with this theory, came up with a theory for NASA to try to figure out how you find inhabited planets. They came up with a totally secular system, a totally scientific system, to describe how all of these things manage to relate and sustain each other. I'm not a good describer of their system, as I've never been an expert in it, to tell you the truth. But, you know, there are secular ways to describe everything, and there are spiritual ways to describe everything. I'm trying to take something that has been considered only the realm of spiritualists, and that is immaterial stuff, and immaterial form, immaterial pattern that grows, and put it under the scientific microscope and give scientists a chance to deal with it, to make it available, to make the understanding of it available, not just to you and me, but to make it available to people both on the believing side of things and the unbelieving side of things. And I'm trying to turn it into a thriller. I'm trying to write it like a detective story. I'm trying to write it so that you cannot leave the pages alone. You have to go on to the next page. And I'm very lucky, you know, James Burke, who is the creator of the Connection series on the BBC and PBS, says that it's the most exciting cliffhanger of a book he can remember reading. So let's hope I've achieved that.
Well, indeed. The other thing is, a few months ago, I was at the City of Hope, a cancer treatment facility, and they're doing a lot of experimenting. And I was there, me, telling them about turmeric and some other things. And I posed this question to them, and it somewhat baffled them. And it was, how come so far, almost every disease we know about, there's a cure in the planet somewhere, if you find it? And they couldn't answer that.
Okay, but my problem in going into a cancer center is the thing that got me so angry at God at the age of 12 and a half that I became an atheist. And that is, every living creature on the face of this planet that's ever come into existence has only one thing guaranteed to it, and that's that eventually it will die. And that means that quintillions of creatures of all kinds, plants, animals, bacteria, fungi, and so many humans, it's beyond belief, humans well, they've died, and not only have they've died under horrible circumstances. This universe has birthed us, or God, or whatever it is, has birthed us with pain. Pain is awful stuff, absolutely awful stuff. You wouldn't wish it upon anybody. So if God is responsible for all of this, if God is responsible for all those people fighting for their lives in the City of Hope when you went to visit it, then that God has got to be cruel as all hell. Now here's the big, and that God has got to be intolerable. Now, the Kutzker rabbi, a rabbi who existed in Poland in 1700, said that God left creation half finished so that we would be required to finish the other half. Okay, let's imagine there's no God. We are the first creatures to evolve. We are the first piles of protons to evolve with a conscience. That's conscience with an N, as in a sense of right and wrong. We are the first ones to have an articulated sense of compassion. We are the first ones to be able to spell out visions of warmth and kindness. And as a consequence, it's our job to make this universe straighten up and fly right. It's our job to make this universe not just as creative as she is now, even more creative, but to do it without these horrible tools of death and torture.
Well, let's compromise for a moment. What if, and I will agree with you, I think there's something very wrong with a God that plays havoc with people, kills people, and makes people not, you know, does not cure people directly. There's something strange about that. What if this belief in God can't control that? It merely becomes the creator, and that's it.
Well, belief, we've always hoped, at least in the days when most of us were religious, and that's been most of human history, we've hoped that if we dealt with God as if God were a stern parent, and if we only did things right, if we only figured out why it was that God was punishing us and stopped doing the things God punishes us for, we could gain control over the universe. But there was a revolution in approximately 700 BC in Greece. And a guy named Thales, in a Greek trading city called Miletus, came up with a way to use other mind tools to figure out how the universe worked. And with those mind tools, he made a prediction about an astronomical eclipse. Well, two nearby nations were making war, and all of a sudden an eclipse struck at noon, and both armies stopped dead in their tracks and were terrified because they were sure this was a sign from God that he was angry. Thales stepped into the situation, and he was a consultant to kings, and I mean he was literally a consultant. He was getting paid money to give the fruits of his mind, and he explained how this had happened in a non-godly way, and that was the beginning of explaining things without God. Well, again, if man has two tasks, if the task of man and woman is to understand the mind of God, to understand how this cosmos works, then it pays to try to dig into these mysteries and solve them, whether you believe in God or don't believe in God. And if you believe with the Kutzker rabbi that if God left us a challenge, and that challenge is to eradicate pain. That challenge is to eradicate death. That challenge is to be all the saviors we have dreamed of. If you believe that God has left us with a responsibility and a challenge for whatever reason, perhaps to see us grow, then we have to take on the biggest challenges available to us. And one of them is turning this universe into a just, kindly, warm, and fantastically creative place.
How do you explain how and why we're here? And I'm not going to take I don't know as an answer.
Right. Well, no, it's not that I don't know. I mean, the big mystery is, okay, you and I are sitting around a coffee table before the beginning of the universe. It's an outdoor cafe table. You are the bright and visionary one, and I'm the crusty old crump. You say, Howard, see, over there, of course, there is no over there because there is no time or space, but over there, all of a sudden, there's going to be a pinprick smaller than a pinprick smaller than a pinprick. And I say, George, you know, I've been sitting around the nothingness for as long as there has been a nothingness. And we've both consumed infinite cups of coffee. And there has never been a pinprick. There never will be a pinprick. And all of a sudden, this pinprick appears, and it explodes at a speed that is utterly beyond belief. It explodes in an unfurling sheet, like a rubber trampoline on a growth binge, trying to take over the universe. At any rate, it just keeps expanding. And it expands with these qualities called time, space, and speed, time, space, and energy. And holy moly, George, you were right. And then you say to me, look, I predict that any second now, the way that a rain cloud precipitates in hail and in rain, drops of rain, that sheet of space and time is going to precipitate in things. And I say, George, now I know you've lost it. Because here we are sitting in the nothing. And why is it called the nothing, George? Because there are no things. There never have been any things. There never will be any things. And whammo, it precipitates into the very first particles. Most of those particles are quarks. Those quarks come in only 16 different kinds. This universe, that's what I call shape shock. That's what I call the supersized surprise. So it's not just us who are startling beyond belief. It's quarks. It's what happens next with quarks. Groups of quarks turn out to be social.
Well, isn't that tell you there's got to be some kind, I don't know what, but some kind of intelligent design behind all of this?
Not intelligent design, but there certainly is a huge mystery. That it's the same mystery as the mystery of how in the world a whole mathematical system got buried in 165 words, even though those words were relatively incomprehensible. How do things become, how are things implicit in something? How can things be pulled out and extracted from something? This is a huge mystery, and it's the mystery that I'm after in this book. And I tell you, I try to tell you the story. There's a hidden history, George. When we say the words reason and the words logic, we say them as if we understand what we're talking about. We really don't. It's taken years and years and years of detective work to figure out the hidden history of how in the world these mind tools came to be. And once you understand how they came to be, you realize how incredibly limited they are. And then you realize how far we have to go beyond them. Now, sometimes in science, it is valuable to come up with answers, but sometimes in science, it's even more valuable to come up with questions. And this book has radically new ways of thinking things through, but it tells you some stories that to me came as an utter shock and surprise. I mean, this is a book Robin Fox, who is the former director of research for the Guggenheim Foundation, says it's a book well about everything, and it tells us that everything we knew about everything is wrong. Yes, absolutely right. It shows us stories we never knew about people that we've thought we knew all of our lives. But ultimately, it's there to get us to be able to think in radically new ways. And even with those radically new ways, God knows how many generations it will take to solve some of these big mysteries. But until you pinpoint a mystery, you can't start solving it.
You just used the word God.
Yes. Well, you know, George, when I was a kid, I read the Bible from cover to cover 7 times, or at least that's what my memory tells me. Memory's not always that accurate. But I found it an absolutely fascinating book. And you know that the first 2 rules of science I learned at the age of 10 were the truth at any price, including the price of your life, and look at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. And I discovered at 12 and a half that the greatest thing right under my nose wasn't under my nose, it was behind it. Everybody that I knew, everybody that I'd ever read of, believed in gods or supernatural forces of some kind, something equivalent to gods. And so the big mystery was, if there are no gods under the earth, if there are no gods in the sky, then the gods are in the human mind, the heart, soul, and gonads.
Maybe.
What are they?
You know, I know one thing. We're not talking about some person, some guy with a white beard sitting in a cloud with a bunch of angels around them with harps. And, you know, I ruled that out of my life a long time ago. But I know that there's something there that is so intelligent, so magnificent, to put this all together. Somebody knew how to make a puzzle.
There is something there that deserves absolute flat-out awe. There is something there of divinity of a kind, even if it's my kind of divinity, an atheist divinity. And the job of science is to begin to step into the territory of the divine and not to desacralize it,
right,
not to take the mystery out of it, but to show the mystery in ways that just floor you.
I mean, they're looking for the Higgs boson. They think they're finding it at CERN. They call it the God particle.
Well, that's a PR stunt. There's nothing particularly oddly about this particle, except that they feel it confers mass, and mass is a big thing in the universe. But what are you and I talking about? We're talking about the material power of immaterial things, and the fact that by just pinpointing all the particles in the cosmos, you'll never get at the really big questions.
We're going to
how things come together in astonishing forms of sociality.
Howard, we're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take final phone calls with you. With Howard Bloom, The God Problem, that's his work. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.